With our very special guest tonight, proud to say, Greg Braden, his work, Deep Truth. And we'll get more into this when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Greg, let's get back into these assumptions, these wrong assumptions, back to the 5,000-year-old civilization. I think you're absolutely right. I think it's an era. It's a cycle. It's a moment. But there have been other moments.
Well, absolutely, George. And as we were saying just before the break, one of the places where this becomes really relevant, I mean, it's always interesting. And, of course, everyone loves to talk about ancient history, ancient civilizations. But where this has direct application to the crises that we're facing now is if we are led to believe, as we have been, that the war is a natural state of human affairs. It's the way humans have always solved their problems, and that war has always been a part of our lives. Then that is a way of thinking that contributes. It makes it very difficult to cooperate and work together to get through the crises that we face as we look at disappearing resources, disappearing food, fresh water. We're solving so many of the problems of the 20th century and now the 21st century by thinking of the solutions in terms of war, and we're led to believe that that is a natural way for humans to solve the problems. The problem with that is that the facts no longer support that assumption. When we go back and look at these advanced civilizations, now twice as old as what we've been led to believe that civilization is, we're looking in the last ice age now, 13,500 years ago, there is a theme that flows through all of the discoveries that have been made, whether it's in northern Peru, the area that is called Kural, or whether it's in Turkey, the area that's called Çatal Hayuk, or the oldest site in Turkey, Göbekli Tepe, whether it's ancient Egypt, whether it's the site that we talked about in India, all of these sites, as different as they are from one another, this is really interesting, George, none of them show any evidence at all of large-scale warfare.
None
of them
Amazing.
Have walls to protect the homes. None of them have walls to protect the cities. There are no evidence of weapons of any kind that have been found at these sites. There are no mass burials, no mutilated bodies that you would expect to see. The first time we see large-scale war used to solve human problems is at the beginning of the cycle that we are in right now, this 5,125-year cycle that ends in December of 2012. This cycle, and our indigenous ancestors called this cycle that we're living the cycle of darkness, the cycle of suffering. And they say that before this cycle, there was what was called the Golden Age, where humankind had outgrown the use of war to solve their problems, and that we must now make a choice as we close out this cycle. Are we going to close it with another great war and lose all that we cherish, or will we outgrow the use of war? We're making that choice right now.
Well, that's a good possibility, Greg. And if I had to make a bet, I would say that humanity will tip toward war.
You know, George,
sadly,
I would tend to agree. I think we're going to come very close, and I think we're going to pull it out at the last minute. And I'm encouraged. Here's the reason why. And this is where all of these deep truths, I think, really begin to come together. And we've only touched on a couple of them tonight. But first of all, the fact that we are really not wired for war. We can certainly make war. And when we are forced into the situations of disappearing resources or, you know, whatever the situation is, we can become warlike, but it's not our truest nature.
Mm-hmm.
What I think we're witnessing, and when we get into the discussion of climate cycles and where that fits into all this, I think what we're seeing, George, is that the crises that we're facing are so massive, so numerous, and of such magnitude that it's going to force us to work together in ways that we never have in the past just to survive the crises. We're going to have to work together as individuals, as communities, and nations initially just to survive the crises. But I think what will happen is that when the crises have passed, we're going to find that we're better people and we have a better world because we work together, and we'll continue in that way. And when we do that, we will have fulfilled, I think, some of the the brightest of our indigenous prophecies rather than the darkest prophecies, we will have fulfilled our destiny rather than succumbing to our fate.
And yet, when you look at civilizations in this cycle, Greg, you know, going all the way back, all they do is fight and kill.
I agree, George. And if you look, this is where, if we study only civilization in a vacuum, or if we look only at Darwin's ideas in a vacuum, or only at these scientific discoveries in a vacuum, we miss the point. It's by bringing all of the information together in the context. And what we begin to see, and what you said is absolutely true, is that the first large-scale wars are recorded 5,000 years ago, precisely when Earth was at the place in space where it is now, and we were experiencing the climate changes then that we are experiencing now. For reasons that are not clearly understood, humankind chose to use competition rather than cooperation to get through those crises. Now, why they did it then and they hadn't done it in the cycles before, I don't know the answer to that. Now, I can speculate, and our indigenous ancestors tell us the stories that tie into a lot of the other guests that have been on Coast to Coast. They say, and this is, I'm deviating now from scientific fact in the book to the traditions of our ancestors. They say that we learned war from our family in other worlds, that we were introduced to the idea of creating weapons 5,000 years ago. And then before that, we didn't. I mean, you think about it, George, who would ever think to take a ball of steel and put spikes in the ball of steel and whirl it around your head to kill somebody else? And where does that idea even come from?
Exactly.
And apparently it did not exist 10,000, 13,000 years ago. We find no evidence of any kind of that kind of warfare, only in what is called the biblical era, right around 3,500 B.C., this is what the archaeological evidence supports. So it's fascinating. And I think we're going to come close. But for reasons that we can also talk about before we finish here tonight, all of our listeners have the opportunity to tip the scales of peace and life and balance in our favor in ways that our own science now is only beginning to understand. And I think we're going to get very close, and I think we'll pull it out.
Gosh, I hope so. Now, the other assumption, false assumption you talked about was consciousness and its separation. Tell me about that.
Sure. Well, in past programs, I know I, myself, and many of your other guests have talked about this so much. This is one of the places where mainstream science is really having a problem with the new discoveries. When I was in school back in the 60s and 70s, I know many of our listeners, when they were in school, we were taught that we're separate from our world, and that what happens inside of our bodies has little, if any, effect beyond our bodies. All of that is changing. Of course, the discoveries in quantum physics are changing that. But what's even changing it more, beyond the quantum world, the understanding of the magnetic field of the Earth, the magnetic field of the human heart, the strongest biomagnetic field in the body is generated by the human heart. It's 5,000 times stronger than the brain. And where scientists really got tipped off on how powerful this field is, George, was in 9/11. In September 11th, there are two satellites, geostationary satellites above North America. The GOES 1 and the GOES 2, every 30 minutes,
right,
those satellites send a signal back to the Earth telling the scientists of the Earth how strong the magnetic field of the Earth is. And it was in September 11th that those fields spiked in a way that scientists hadn't recognized before. And they said, you know, what on Earth? What on Earth is going on to spike the magnetic fields of the Earth that connect and sustain all life? And what they came to understand was the spike began at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. It was 15 minutes after the first plane hit the first tower of the World Trade Center. And the scientists believe that it took about 15 minutes for the images of what was happening in New York to be carried by the media around the world. And in that 15 minutes, the people of
the this world, planet. Yeah.
Billions of people had a genuine heart-based response. They weren't thinking so much. It was emotion. Some of it was anger, some was shock, disbelief, but it was heart-based emotion. And it was the combined effect of so many human hearts experiencing emotion in a moment in time that spiked the fields, the magnetic fields of the Earth that can connect and sustain all life. And the scientist said, you know, my God, it changed the way that we think of our relationship to the world and gives new meaning to this idea of Gaia.
They did not tie that in, though, at that time, did they?
It was not long after that that they tied it in at that time. And the key was that in that instance, it took something horrible to bring the people of the Earth together in that moment of outpouring. The question is, can we create those effects without having the disaster, without having a 9/11? And the answer to that has led to a series of studies through the Institute of Heart Math. I know you've talked to some of those people, and most of our listeners are familiar with the Institute of Heart Math in Northern California, a project that is called the Global Coherence Initiative, GCI, right, where they are developing a network of sensors, ground-based sensors, on many different places, not just in North America, but across the world, that are independently measuring these fields and the relationship between human response in these fields and telling us a lot about our relationship to the fields and also teaching the human condition that is called coherence, heart-brain coherence. And when we can create the feeling in our hearts that is called coherence, and it is actually identified as 0.10 hertz. It's a very low frequency signal. What we find is that is the optimum signal that connects us. It links us with these fields of the Earth in very profound and meaningful ways. It's where healing begins in the human body, and it's where we are connected with these fields of the Earth. Now that scientists understand this, the question is, what do we feed this field of the Earth that connects and sustains all life? And when we as individuals create coherence for this field, it supports cooperation, it supports peace, and people working together, and this is what the studies are showing us now. So this idea of global coherence stemming from personal coherence is a very powerful add-on when we understand this relationship to the magnetic fields of the Earth, and it's especially significant when we look at the context, because here we are at this time of the greatest crises of human history, in this narrow window of time, and now the same science is telling us of the crises, is telling us that we have the ability to tip those scales of life and peace in our favor.
It's going to throw science against the ceiling, isn't it? When they see the results of this ongoing and realize that the conscious mind is very powerful, I think science is going to go nuts, Greg.
Well, there are, when we talk about science, it's like talking about governments, George. There are governments within governments.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
That is so true. I mean, governments, science, it's the same. They have their own agendas, don't they?
Well, some do. There's some very innovative scientists, very far-reaching scientists that are open to new ideas, and some are very entrenched in the old ideas. Some are willing to embrace what the discoveries are showing, and some are not. But all of this is changing, and we're bringing all of this information together in new and meaningful ways.
And when we talk about, you know, Greg, space is empty, it's not empty. There's something in between. Call it the ether. I always call it the wireless internet. That's what we have out in the universe, where we're all connected all the time. You know, science, I think, will find that probably before they find anything else, that there are, you know, indeed, this what we call dark matter is probably very real.
Well, absolutely. And I know our listeners, excuse me,
We're losing your voice there. Greg, you want to get a drink of water?
Well, we'll do it right now.
You go do that. You get a drink of water.
I did it as we were speaking. So
okay, very good.
Our listeners on Coast to Coast, I know we've all heard of the unified field theory and the search for that unified field theory. One of the reasons that it's been so elusive is because historically science has written consciousness right out of the equation. It's written us out of the equation. And what the new studies are showing, we talk about this in many other books, I know many of your guests have talked about this, is that consciousness is the stuff that connects everything. It's part of the equation, and when we write consciousness back into the equation, the mathematics work out in very surprising ways, and the science now is supporting us. John Wheeler, Princeton University, was a tremendous proponent. Before his death, he just died in 2008. He was a colleague of Einstein's. Tremendous proponent of consciousness being a part of our physical reality. And he actually said that we must cross the word observer out of all of the textbooks. He said there are no observers, that we are all participants. We are influence the world. We don't control and manipulate, but we influence the world through thoughts, feelings, emotions, and beliefs. And of course, we've all heard of the quantum experiments that support that. When we observe the stuff our world is made of, when we observe a quantum particle, that particle changes the way it behaves. We are made of those particles. And the scientific community, this is very important, they're not arguing over whether or not we influence our physical reality. The question is, to what degree do we influence our bodies and the world around us? And the answer to that question is what drives a scientist crazy, because the answer is that it depends upon the focus that we place in our consciousness, and in that level of focus is the core of our most cherished and ancient spiritual and indigenous traditions, how we achieve that focus to create the effects in our bodies and in the world around us.
Climate change, you've looked at things. You're trained as a scientist yourself, a geologist specifically. What are your thoughts of climate change? You know, I want to get as many different views on as I can, Greg. I believe that we're in an Earth cycle. Climates are going to change, and they will historically change. We may, as humans, be moving things a little faster, but I think this planet's going to go through this evolutionary change anyway.
Well, George, I'm just going to begin by saying, for me personally, I just want to be very clear on my position on this. We definitely need to clean up our act on this planet. We definitely need to go green. We need to get off of fossil fuels and find new innovative ways to, not primitive ways, but innovative ways to create the power to sustain a global
system. I agree with that, too. I mean,
so having said that, when I am asked that question, and to answer that question for myself, I had to go directly to the data and not the interpretation that so many of us are being fed through mainstream media. In 1999, the scientists of the Earth from many, many different countries, in an amazing act of cooperation, they recognized that climate change is happening. And they said, we don't know why, but the poles are melting. And as they melt, we're losing the records of Earth's past. We need to save as much of the record of Earth's past as we can. In 1999, they drilled to the thickest part of the Antarctic ice.
Hold on right there. That's out there at Vostok Lake, I think. We're going to come right back with that on Coast to Coast AM. I want to let you know, Tuesday, our book, Talking to the Dead, hits the bookstores. And, of course, Amazon.com has got it available for you right now at a steep discount as well. If you want to go there, it's called Talking to the Dead, and Rosemary Ellen Guiley will be George Knapp's special guest Sunday talking about that and some of the ways people are trying to communicate to talk to the dead. We'll come back in a moment, continue talking with Greg Braden, Deep Truth, on Coast to Coast AM. Greg Braden, we were talking about what happened when the scientists dug into the ice core there at the Antarctic. That was Vostok Lake, wasn't it?
Vostok Lake was the area in 1999. It was the thickest portion of the Antarctic ice layer, and that's why they chose to drill all the way to the bottom of that layer. Now, for listeners that may not be familiar with precisely why this is so important, every year there's a new layer of ice that's deposited on the poles, and in that layer of ice, there's a record of physical and key parameters of what Earth was like during that year. So there's dust particles that are captured in the ice, telling us if we had volcanoes happening or not. There are little air bubbles that have the actual carbon dioxide levels and oxygen levels of hundreds of thousands of years past. So from these ice core layers, we can tell about the strength of the sun, the strength of the magnetic field. We can tell if the sea levels were high or low. We can tell about the temperatures, the levels of gases, all kinds of things. So the scientists knew that they were losing this valuable library of the Earth's history because the climate is changing. And together, in this amazing act of cooperation, they drilled to the deepest layer. The French Polytechnic Institute has made this data available. And I think, George, even the scientists were amazed at how many layers of ice were recovered in this drill. Each layer is 1 year. Jeez. And they recovered over 420,000 layers of ice in these cores. All of a sudden, scientists had 420,000 years of the history of the Earth to look back and see if what is happening now is truly anomalous. Is Earth broken? And have we broken the Earth? And this is the question that they were asking. Now, the data is still being analyzed, but I think that the really key elements of the data that are relevant to what we're talking about here is about our relationship, carbon dioxide levels, temperature levels, global warming. Did humans cause global warming? And we have been told in no uncertain terms that humans are the cause of global warming. That's what the media has asked us to believe. And now to answer your question, George, what I see from the data and others, the very prestigious journal Nature, volume 329, page, I think it's 4414 to 4418, I believe is what it is, have published many of these results. And what's interesting is that the mainstream would lead us to believe that it's an open and shut case, that humans cause global warming, that we create the carbon dioxide, that's creating the warming, and so we need to change the world to stop this. What the data shows, I'm just going to share what the data shows, and then we can talk about what it means.
Okay.
The data very clearly shows, when we look at the charts, that the temperature levels rise about 400 to 800 years before the carbon dioxide levels rise. So this tells us two things. When we look into these charts, we're looking at 420,000 years of the history of the Earth. What we see is a massive warming and cooling cycle about every 100,000 years. And within that 100,000 years, there are smaller cycles of which we are living right now. The fact that the carbon dioxide existed in such quantities in the past tells us that we did not create all of the carbon dioxide that is believed to cause the problems in the atmosphere today. Have we contributed? Absolutely. Did we cause the global warming? Absolutely not. We can say that categorically because it has happened so many times in the past, and the ice cores are showing us this. Does the carbon dioxide cause the warming? The data suggests it doesn't because the temperatures rise 400 to 800 years before the carbon dioxide and the methane levels actually rise. So is there a correlation? There is, but it's not what many people would lead us to believe. The correlation is the temperatures rise first, and then the gases rise. So the question is, what causes it? And this goes back to the first hour of our program. Earth's rhythmic dance in space. Earth changes its orbit, tilt, angle, and wobble. On a rhythmic basis, it changes our relationship to the sun. And when that happens, we go through these changes. Our ancestors knew about it. They lived through it. They told us about it. But it's new to us. It hasn't happened in the memory of this civilization. Now, the reason that many people believe that, that we're causing the problem. And this is where context is so important. There's a very famous chart that shows the temperatures of the oceans and the earth from 1880 until the year 2000. And there, it looks kind of like a stock market. It goes up and down, up and down, up and down, but the general trend is up. And if you look only from 1880 until the year 2000, there obviously is a warming trend on the planet.
Sure.
And it could look alarming until you step back and take that segment and place it into the larger cycle. And the bottom line, George, is that we appear to be on track with where we always are when we reach this point in the cycle. And I am less concerned about global warming causing the problems on Earth than I am about how we treat one another as we deal with the problems that the warming has caused. I think that's the danger right now.
I think you're spot on, Greg. Absolutely. And,
well, the second half of this, the flip side, is global warming. If you look at geologic history, it's intense. And we are definitely living in intense time. But it's relatively brief, George. And the studies suggest, the data suggests, that global warming actually topped out. And the ice has been thicker in the last couple of years and is actually accumulating again in Antarctica than it has for some time. But the warming is brief and intense, but it's what comes after the warming that's the big problem, and that is the cooling cycle. And the cooling cycle is a problem because it affects primarily the northern hemisphere, where most of the landmass, the people of the Earth, and our food happen to be located. So is climate change happening? The answer is yes. Did we cause it? No. Have we contributed to it? Possibly. We've definitely contributed to CO2 levels. But the CO2 existed in cycles 420,000 years ago when we weren't here. And where this is important, and this all comes back to this whole idea of the deep truths, the false assumptions, and how we deal with them. I think our listeners probably remember the climate summit that happened in Copenhagen last year, 2010. I was actually in Europe while it was going on. The beginning of the week, the hopes were high because the leaders from so many nations had come together, and the thinking was that they would address this climate change in a meaningful way. And I think by the end of the week, those hopes began to vanish very quickly. And here's the reason why. Based on the false assumptions of science, the leaders and the committees, what they could have done, they could have said this. They could have said, climate change is happening. We don't understand it fully, but it is impacting the lives, the ways of life, of people in our nations. Entire cities are being washed from the coastlines and superstorms, and our indigenous people's ability to live the way they have for centuries is disappearing. Let's help one another get through, adapt to the climate change. That's what could have happened. What did happen, and this is a gross generalization, but it's essentially what happened, was that through the false assumptions of science, the belief was that climate change is human-induced, and that they began finger-pointing at the nations they believed created the most change and trying to assign a financial penalty, which caused a lot of hard feelings and makes it very difficult to work together and cooperate to get through the problem if the belief is that it's human-induced. So this is an example of where the false assumptions of science have had a detrimental effect on our ability to work together. We're not going to stop climate change. The only way you can stop it is to change the angle and the tilt and the wobble of Earth and space, and that's something we definitely don't want to mess with. But we can adapt to it, and we can learn from the past. And this is where I believe it helps us, it behooves us, to look at these civilizations in the past, because they lived in their time through the cycles we're living through in ours. They wrote to us. They told us what to expect. They told us that they worked together to get through them, and they did well. So this is another place where I think this is so critical. And by the way, the data that begins in 1880. The reason 1880.
That's a long way too.
Well, it's the beginning point. That was the first year that records, consistent records, were kept through the National Weather Service for global temperatures. But if we look just before 1880, what we see is that Earth was coming out of a cold snap that was called a Little Ice Age, is responsible for the great potato famine, for example, in Northern Europe. So while it looks like the warming was happening in 1880, if you go just before that, what you see is that there was the cooling that happened just before that. So our recognition of where we are in the cycles and the ability to work together in many cases hinges upon our beliefs of what causes the climate change. And if we can recognize the cycles, then I think we can come to terms with the best way to work together to adapt rather than trying to control the climate of the Earth.
What would you hope for people who read Deep Truth to come away with?
You know, each of these, and I've had some feedback from people that say, Greg, you didn't go into as much depth as I would have liked for you to on each topic. And that was not the purpose of the book. You know, Graham Hancock has written amazing books about the civilizations of the past, and David Wilcock has written amazing books about the physics.
Sure.
The purpose of this book was to help us to understand why we are thinking the way we're thinking and how that thinking has led to unsustainable ways of life and the crises that we're facing now that the experts are telling us. We've got to figure this stuff out in 5 to 8 years. And once we recognize the deepest truths of our existence, the new discoveries in the science that's not being shared publicly, then I think the answers are clear and the choices are obvious. We don't need someone telling us how to live and what to do when we understand the relationships. But without that understanding, George, it looks like just random, sporadic things falling apart for no apparent reason, and you know, everything is crumbling at the end of this great cycle. But I think, again, it's fascinating to me because the bulk of my adult life has been devoted to studying the indigenous traditions of the past and the parallels of what they experienced in their time and how the best science of our time helps us to understand their experience. And when we begin to look at the past from this perspective, is it ancient? Yes. Is it obsolete? Absolutely not. There's this continuity in human experience. And if we can learn that cooperation rather than competition is the way to deal with the crises that threaten our survival and all that we cherish, and if we can learn that advanced civilizations, that war was their downfall in the past, but there was a time when war didn't exist, a cycle when there's no evidence of war or weapons, and if war is a learned habit, maybe we can unlearn that. And I believe, George, and you and I may see differently on this, I believe, having worked in a defense department behind the scenes during the Cold War years, one of the most frightening times in the history of the Earth, the reasons that have always justified war in the past have become obsolete. The thinking has always been that at the end of a war, there's a winner, there's a loser, and that there's something that the winner can use and benefit from.
Right.
The technology that we have today makes both of those premises obsolete. And I think this generation, I think we're going to come close, but I think we will be the generation that walks away from the use of large-scale war to solve our problems because we have outgrown that way of thinking, and we're witnessing it happening in the presence of these changes. The climate change and the crises are forcing us to work together, and in that cooperation, just as quickly as the Berlin Wall came down, just as quickly as the Cold War ended, I think we're going to find ourselves in a very short period of time recognizing the deepest truths of our existence. And I hope we all wake up one morning and say, what the hell were we thinking?
Yeah. I hope you're right, Greg.
I'm encouraged by what I'm seeing behind the scenes. Some things that I share publicly, some I can't, and what I'm seeing publicly as well. It's a rough road, George, and I cannot say for sure why we've chosen such a circuitous path, but I firmly believe this is where we're going, and I think we're going to see it in our lifetimes.
Well, let's hope so, because we're long overdue for it, And I'm not sure we can survive if we don't.
Well, we're moving toward a global world, and I know that we all know that. People ask me all the time, Greg, you think we're moving towards a global government? And I say, well, what does that mean to you? We already have global commerce. We have a global economic system. We have global communications. We're working globally to solve problems. Where do those solutions end, and where does the government begin? I think to a large degree, it's already here. But what I would expect, George, I'm going to make the statement, and then we can talk about what it means. I think we're going to see the United Nations playing a much larger role in the coming years than it has in the past. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? It's all going to be determined by how it's implemented. And I think we're beginning to see that with the Millennium Development Goals. Some of our listeners are familiar with those. If they're not, I invite listeners to look. Google Millennium Development Goals from the United Nations, the goals that were set forth in the year 2000 that they hope to achieve by 2015. Some of those, you look at those and you think, I ask myself, is the good thing or a bad thing? It's how these goals are implemented. But what I know for sure, when we look at the trends, is the world changing? Absolutely. Are we moving forward? Absolutely. Are we going to go back to what we had? Probably not. Can we stop the change? Probably not. But I believe we can work together to soften the impact of where this rapid global change is leading us. And these core truths, the fact that we're not really wired for war, that cooperation is the model of nature, the fact that civilization is cyclic and we've done this stuff before, the fact that we're connected in ways we're only beginning to understand. When we bring all of these together, they change the way we think of ourselves, and that changes the way we approach the solutions.
You're convinced, though, that mankind can change this?
We've done it before. We've done it before. We see it in the archaeological record, and we learn about it through the indigenous traditions, depending on which tradition you're talking about. Some of our ancestors say we've lived through three cycles in the past. The Hopi say that we're moving into the fourth. The Mayan calendar says that we're ending the fifth, moving into the sixth. Egyptian traditions talk about the cycles. And the archaeological evidence is now supporting these beliefs. We've been here much longer than we've been led to believe, and we've lived through cyclic change on the earth. We have not done it in the memory of this civilization. And as the same science, George, that tells us that we're in crisis reveals the deepest truths of our existence, if we can embrace these, teach them to the young people. Our young people are being asked to solve the problems that we've created in the world, but they're being limited in the way they think by the old ideas that led to the crises. That's what is being taught in the schools today. And it's changing. It's beginning to change slowly. And programs like this and colleagues like Dr. Bruce Lipton, a dear friend and colleague of mine, I know you've had him on the program.
Absolutely. Yep.
Changing the way we think of cells and biology. Lynn McTaggart, another dear friend and colleague, is changing the way we think of our relationship to the world, to the earth.
Greg, so when we come back, we're going to continue talking. We'll also take some phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM.